Steve is our eighth class on the most important Talmudic passages. Today's subject is authority and democracy, inside and outside. It's a continuation of last week's class. And the truth is that the story, the Talmudic Agadah, that's at the center of this week's story, I already brought in the sheets last week. We didn't get to it, so we're doing it today. So you can look either at the sheets from last week or the sheets from today. Everyone have sheets? Okay. Why don't I take a minute to summarize what we saw last time? Last time was the story in Tractate Rosh Hashanah about the sanctification of the new moon, in which Rabban Gamliel apparently accepted witnesses who testified to the sanctification of the new moon, and they were mistaken, it turns out, or they were purposely lying. We're not sure. And Rabbi Yeshua knew the truth. But Rabban Gamliel had accepted the witnesses, and therefore Yom Kippur was scheduled to be on that in that month at a day that was not the right day for him, as far as he understood objectively. And Rabban Gamliel demanded from Rabbi Yeshua to accept the calendar, accept the Yom Kippur as decided by Rabban Gamliel, the head of the Sanhedrin, for all the Jewish people. And Rabbi Yeshua was faced with a dilemma: to uphold the truth as he understood it, or to uphold the authority of the duly constituted body that decides the calendar for the Jewish people. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible dilemma he found himself in. With the help of two of his colleagues, one of them being Rabbi Akiva, he came to the conclusion that he should accept the authority of the Sanhedrin of Rabban Gamliel and forego his own understanding of truth. And Rabbi Akiva's logic was that we can learn from the Torah through a creative drasha of the rabbis that the Torah gives authority to the rabbis as representatives of Jewish people to decide what reality is. And if the Jewish people decide that X day is Yom Kippur, the next day is Yom Kippur, it doesn't really matter what astronomically is quote-unquote true or correct. God, as it were, will accept the decision of the Jewish people and will judge the Jewish people, or will forgive the Jewish people, will atone for the Jewish people on Day of Atonement whenever they decide, whenever the Jews decide that Day of Atonement is. And that averted a crisis of leadership and a schism within the Jewish people. Everyone accepted the position and the authority of the Sanhedrin, and the Jewish people lived happily ever after with, number one, a sense of central authority, and then number two, a sense of partnership with God, that the Jewish people have the authority together with God to decide what is right for the Jewish people based on interpretation of the Torah. That was last week.
I guess it's sort of a shame that we don't have a central body anymore to that we all abide by, because we have such strife amongst the...
Right. Some say it's a shame. Some say, thank God, we don't have such a central body.
Yeah. I mean, I can see both ways, but I mean, it sort of contributes to the strife.
Well, don't you have a central body for each?
Yeah, but each is different, you know. Each makes different decisions.
Wouldn't you say there's a central body in Israel?
I'm afraid if I get into it, we'll never get out of it. So let me just say one word. I am myself part of a group of rabbis in Israel who have basically come to the conclusion that although there is a central authority in Israel, it's turned out to be worse than not having a central body. Let's just leave it at that. Politics is complicated.
But it's interesting that last week we heard Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and in England, so I guess that's political,
right?
I'll just say that
to us in America, at least to me, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks is the best thing since sliced bread. In England, he doesn't have too much authority.
Oh, really? Oh, that's funny.
No, he's completely embattled.
It's just a name.
Right. He's not accepted by the Reform, the Conservative, or the Ultra-Orthodox.
Oh,
who's left?
Who is he accepted?
Say it again?
Who is he accepted by?
The Queen.
The Queen! That we got.
Yeah, and again, I have nothing against Rabbi Sacks. I think he's great. But as a political leader, he's very, very embattled. Anyway, so here we are. Today is December 5th, And we're studying a story.
Is he affiliated with any kind of a reform or?
He's Orthodox, but the ultra-Orthodox don't accept him.
Okay.
And the Reform Conservative don't accept him.
Okay.
Now, I should be honest. The Reform Conservative don't accept him, because he doesn't accept them. We are studying Babylonian Talmud Tractate Brachot, page 27b and 28a. In order to do that, I have to give some background. The subject is going to be the ostensible subject that the discussion of authority and democracy base itself on. The ostensible subject is prayer, tefillah. And to be more specific, it is the evening prayer, Tfilat Aravit. Now everyone knows, has heard, that Judaism has three prayer services a day, except on Yom Kippur when there are four. Three prayer services a day, beginning in the morning, Shachrit, in the afternoon, Mincha, and in the evening, Aravit. The matter is that the status of Aravit, the evening prayer, in America they call it Ma'ariv, it's the same Hebrew root, means evening. The status of the Ma'ariv prayer is different than the status of the Shachrit and the Mincha prayers. As far as Shachrit and Mincha, there is across-the-board agreement that they are obligatory. Whereas the evening prayer, Ma'ariv, there's a question, there's an argument whether it is obligatory or whether it is not obligatory. That's going to be the centerpiece of our discussion. Now, why do we get to such a stage in which we're not sure if the Ma'ariv prayer is obligatory or voluntary? For the following reason. The Talmud talks about two sources for prayer, two foundations for the idea of Jews praying. One is korbanot, sacrifice, that the three prayers are based on the three daily sacrifices in the temple. More about that another minute. That's korbanot. Another approach is, no, not korbanot, but avot, patriarchs. There are three prayer services because each of the three patriarchs davened Avram Shachrit, Yitzchak Mincha, and Yaakov Ma'ariv. The disagreement, is Ma'ariv, the evening prayer, obligatory or voluntary, might have to do with which of those two models of prayer are we basing ourselves upon? On the model of avot patriarchs? And if so, as I'll explain in a minute, we come to the conclusion that all three prayer services are obligatory? Or is it korbanot, sacrifices? If that's the model, we may come to the conclusion that only two of the three prayer services are obligatory, but the third, the evening prayer, is voluntary. Now the details. So with the details, we have to open up the Torah, open up the Chumash. And we're going to look at Exodus chapter 29. Exodus chapter 29, 29:38. Exodus chapter 29, verse 38. In the JPS English only, it's page 132. What it says is as follows. 29:38. Now this is what you shall offer upon the altar. Two yearly lambs each day regularly. You shall offer the one lamb in the morning, and you shall offer the other at twilight. Twilight means the afternoon. There shall be a tenth of a measure of choice flour with a quarter of a hin of beaten oil mixed in, a libation of a quartering of wine for one lamb. You shall offer the other lamb at twilight, which means afternoon, repeating with it the meal offering of the morning with its libation offering by fire for a pleasing odor to the Lord, a regular burnt offering throughout the generations at the entrance tent of meeting before the Lord. That's the daily sacrifice. And how many daily sacrifices do we just read there are?
Two.
And there's not three. There's one in the morning, one in the afternoon. What happened to the temple is, in the tabernacle in the temple, is that in the nighttime, after the morning sacrifice and after the afternoon sacrifice in the nighttime, if there were any pieces of meat that fell off the fire on the altar, they put them back.
They were re-sacrificed.
They were re-sacrificed. They were recycled. And the Talmud says that the evening prayer is based on the model of the putting the meat that fell off of the fire back onto the fire in the nighttime. But of course, there weren't always pieces of meat to put back in the fire. That's the foundation for thinking that although Shachrit prayer is obligatory, there was a morning sacrifice. Although the afternoon prayer is obligatory, there's an afternoon sacrifice. But the nighttime prayer, Mariv, is not obligatory because in the temple it wasn't obligatory. Sometimes there was more meat to put on the fire at night, sometimes there wasn't. So that's the foundation of those who would say that the evening prayer, Mariv, is not obligatory. You can do it if you want, and you cannot do it if you don't want. On the other hand, there's a whole different model of the foundation of prayer, which is Avot, which is the three Avot, the patriarchs, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And we'll find that there is a foundation, a Midrashic foundation, to say that Avraham davened Shachrit, and Yitzhak davened Mincha, and Yaakov davened Ma'ariv. And the foundation of Yaakov davening Ma'ariv is no less strong than for the other two Avot. So according to this model, Ma'ariv prayer is just as obligatory as the other two prayers. So let's just see the verses in the Torah. As far as Avraham, we're looking at Genesis 19. Genesis 19:27, which is page 28 in the English only. Genesis 19, verse 27. This is right after Abraham had prayed to God to save the cities of Sodom, and God agreed. But in the end, there weren't even 10 righteous men there. God destroyed the cities. And right after the destruction, it says in Genesis 19, verse 27, next morning, Abraham hurried. And the word in English is he got up early. In Hebrew. Next morning, Avram got up early to a place where he had stood before the Lord when he had talked to God about saving the cities. And looking down upon Sodom and Gomorrah, or the land of the plain, he saw the smoke of the land rising like the smoke of a kiln. So since the verse says that Avram got up early in the morning and he went to the place where he had stood before the Lord, the Midrash understands if he went back to the same place, he was intending to stand before the Lord. And when was it? It was in the morning. That's the foundation for saying that Avraham provides us with the paradigm of approaching God in the morning, and we follow that paradigm by davening the Shachrit prayer. That's Avraham. And now we get to Yitzhak. Yitzhak is chapter 24 of Genesis. Genesis 24, verse 62. And in the JPS English only, it's page 36. Isaac, verse 62, had just come back from the vicinity of Be'er Lahai Ro'i, for he was settled in the region of the Negev. And Isaac went out lasuach in the field towards evening. I read the Hebrew word lasuach. Isaac went out lasuach in the field towards evening, and looking up, he saw camels approaching. Raising her eyes, Rebekah saw Isaac. She alighted from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field towards us?" So the question is, what was he doing in the field? The word in Hebrew is lasuach. And there are a lot of interpretations. What does it mean? One interpretation is praying, meditating. And that's the foundation for the idea that Isaac prayed the afternoon prayer. It was towards evening. It was when the sun was going down. And on that foundation, we have the idea of the Mincha prayer, which would be obligatory because Yitzhak established the paradigm. And now for the third prayer, the third patriarch, which is Yaakov, in Genesis 28. Genesis 28:10, which is page 43 in the JPS English only. 28:10. Yaakov left Beersheba and set out for Haran. He came upon a certain place and stopped there for night, for the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of that place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place. He had a dream, a stair was set on the ground, and its top reached to the sky, and angels of God were going up and down. And the Lord was standing beside him, and he said, "I'm Lord of your fathers," etc., etc., etc. So what do you see? That at nighttime, Jacob had an encounter with God.
He also argued with God and the angels.
Argued here?
No, not here.
Not here. He didn't argue. He just said, wow, I didn't know God was in this place. So here's the foundation for Yaakov having a prayerful experience at night. And therefore we say that the Jews also should have a prayerful experience at night. So the idea is, just to summarize, if we follow the model of the patriarchs, then the evening prayer is no different in status than the other two prayers. If we follow the model of the sacrifices, then the evening prayer doesn't seem to have a very strong foundation. It's optional. That's the background of our Talmudic story for today. Good?
Okay.
Good. Now we're going to read the story. We'll read through the whole story, and we'll go back and explain and discuss. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Brachot, pages 27b to 28a.
Do I have last week's?
Do I have last week's sheet? I actually do.
Anybody else need it?
But that's all I have from last week.
Isn't that what you just handed out?
No, I gave out... Again, last week's page has last week's story and this week's story. Whereas this week's page only has this week's. So I don't have any more from last week. But you can always write me an email and ask me for it. And I just send it easily, no problem. Yes, I do have another one from last week.
Oh.
Okay, I do.
Yeah, I was going to copy it anyway.
We didn't. Yeah.
This is, last week was one that starts with Babylonian Talmud, Brachot.
No, that's this week. No, that's this week.
Thank you. Oh, that's...
Well, I guess I don't have last week.
Wait a minute. It's on the second. No,
but we don't need last week's.
We don't need last week.
Again, if you have last week's sheet, the material we're reading now is there. If you don't have it, then you have this week's sheet, and it's there.
Yeah.
Okay. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Brachot. Everyone see Tractate Brachot?
Yeah, 27b and 28a.
Yes.
Okay, we're on the same page.
We're on the same page. For Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, with regard to the evening tefillah, Rabban Gamliel says it is compulsory, whereas Rabbi Yeshua says it is optional. Remember that Rabban Gamliel is the same Rabban Gamliel as last week, the head of the Sanhedrin. Remember Rabbi Yeshua is the same Rabbi Yeshua as last week, the one who had a different understanding of the astronomical circumstances than Rabban Gamliel did. Now, who is telling us that these two rabbis disputed? It's Rav Yehuda in the name of Shmuel. Shmuel lives in about the year 200 of the Common Era. Rav Yehuda lives about 250 of the Common Era. And they are in Babylonia. And they're reciting this ancient controversy of Rabban Gamliel and Rav Yeshua, who are in the generation after the destruction of the Temple. Rabban Gamliel was head of the Sanhedrin from about the year 90 of the Common Era to about the year 110 of the Common Era. That's the generation after the destruction of the Temple. Abaye says, the halakha is as stated by the one who says it is compulsory. Rav says the halakha follows the one who says it's optional. Abaye and Rav are in the year 300 of the Common Era. What we learn from all this is that the disagreement between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua concerning the evening prayer, is it obligatory or is it optional, that argument went on for another 150 years at least. It wasn't solved. There was no final word. It was discussed in the year 90 of the Common Era, and it's still being discussed after the year 300 of the Common Era. It is related that a certain disciple came before Rabbi Yeshua and asked him, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? He replied, it is optional. He then presented himself before Rabban Gamliel and asked him, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? He replied, it's compulsory. But he said, did not Rabbi Yeshua tell me that it's optional? He said, wait till the shield bearers enter the Beit Midrash. Shield bearers is another way to talk about the sages. And the image, of course, is one of war.
Is one of what?
War.
War.
They battle each other. When the shield bearers came in, someone rose and inquired, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? Rabban Gamliel required, is compulsory. Said Rabban Gamliel to the sages, is there anyone who disputes this? Rabbi Yeshua replied to him, no. He said to him, did they not report you to me as saying that it's optional? He then went on, Yeshua, stand up and let them testify against you. Rabbi Yeshua stood up and said, were I alive and the witness dead, the living could contradict the dead. But now that he is alive and I am alive, how can the living contradict the living? Rabban Gamliel remained sitting and expounding, and Rabbi Yeshua remained standing until all the people there began to shout and say to Chutzpit, the announcer, stop, and he stopped. The announcer means the following. Rabban Gamliel is here teaching a room of between 100 and 400 students. He's speaking in a whisper, and he's speaking into the air of the announcer, the ear, E-A-R, the announcer. The announcer is a person who has a very, very strong voice, and he takes everything Rabban Gamliel says and speaks it to the audience. It's a microphone. But the rabbis, as you can see, said, turn off the microphone. Once they turned it off, Rabban Gamliel was stopped in his tracks. Again, I'm explaining very little, just so we can get the basic outline. We'll go back another 5 minutes and read it again. Then they said, how long is Rabban Gamliel to go on insulting Rabbi Yeshua? Concerning the new year last year, he insulted him. That's what we learned last week. He insulted him in the matter of the firstborn in the fear of Rabbi Tzadok. Now insults him again. The Rabbi Tzadok matter is Rabbi Tzadok had a firstborn animal, and there was a certain halakhic issue with that animal. He asked Rabbi Yeshua, what should I do? Rabbi Yeshua said X. He asked Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Gamliel said Y. And it was brought to the Sanhedrin in the same fashion as here. And Rabbi Gamliel insulted Rabbi Yeshua over that, just like he did in this case concerning the evening prayer. Back to the source. Come, let us depose him. Whom shall we appoint instead? We can hardly appoint Rabbi Yeshua because he is one of the parties involved. We can hardly appoint Rabbi Akiva because perhaps Rabban Gamliel will bring a curse on him because he has no ancestral merit. Rabbi Akiva didn't come from a family of scholars. Perhaps he was even a convert, according to some opinions. Let us then appoint Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who is a student of Rabbi Yeshua, who is wise and rich and the 10th in descent from Ezra. That's Ezra of the book of Ezra. He is wise, so that if anyone puts a question to him, he will be able to answer it. He is rich, so that if occasion arises for paying court to Caesar for going to Rome, he'll be able to do so. He can hire a ship on his own. He is 10th in descent from Ezra, so that he has ancestral merit, and Rabbi Gamliel cannot bring a curse on him. They went and said to him, to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, will your honor consent to become head of the academy? He replied, I will go and consult with the members of my family. That's euphemism for his wife. He went and consulted his wife. She said to him, perhaps they will depose you later on. He replied to her, there's a proverb, that a man use a cup of honor for one day, even if it be broken the next. She said to him, you have no white hair. He was 18 years old that day. And a miracle was wrought for him, and 18 rows of hair on his beard turned white. That is why Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, and this is now a quote from the Haggadah Pesach, Hare ani kaven shivim shana velo zechiti sheteyamer yitziat mitzrayim beleilot. Behold, I am like 70 years old. And he did not say 70 years old. He looked like 70, he was really only 18. A Tana taught, a rabbi taught, on that day the doorkeeper was removed and permission was given to the disciples to enter. For Rabban Gamliel had issued a proclamation saying, no disciple whose character does not correspond to his exterior may enter the Beit Midrash. On that day, many stools were added. Rabbi Yochanan said, there's a difference of opinion on this matter between Abba Yosef ben Dustein, the rabbis. One authority says that 400 stools were added. The other says 700 stools were added. Rabban Gamliel became alarmed and said, perhaps, God forbid, I withheld Torah from Israel. He was shown in his dream white casks full of ashes. This, however, really meant nothing. He was only shown this to appease him. Atana taught, a rabbi taught, Tractate Edu Yod was formulated on that day. A whole tractate of the Mishnah. We'll explain later what that is. And wherever the expression on that day is used, it refers to that day. And there was no halakha about which any doubt exists in the Beit Midrash, which was not fully elucidated. Rabban Gamliel also did not absent himself from the Beit Midrash a single hour, even though he was deposed. As we have learned, on that day Yehuda, an Ammonite proselyte, a convert, came before them in the Beit Midrash. He said to them, "Am I permitted to enter the assembly? Can I marry a Jewish girl?" Rabbi Yeshua said to him, "You are permitted to enter the congregation. You can get married to a Jewish girl. You don't have to marry just a convert." Said Rabban Gamliel to him, "Is it not already laid down?" Oh, I made a mistake. It should be an Ammonite. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter into the assembly of the Lord. It's a specific verse in the Torah. How can you contradict the verse? It says they can't get married to a Jew. Deuteronomy.
Rabbi Moses was married to a...
Not an Ammonite.
Moabite.
A Midianite.
No, what was it?
Midianite. Oh. Yeah. Tzipora was a Midianite. But this is an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter into the assembly of the Lord. A specific verse in Deuteronomy chapter 23. Rabbi Yeshua replied to him, "Do Ammon and Moab still reside in their original homes? Sancharib, king of Assyria, long ago went up and mixed up all the nations. As it says, I have removed the bonds of the peoples and have robbed their treasures and have brought down as one mighty their inhabitants. And whatever is separated from a group is assumed to belong to a larger section of the group." What that means is the following. The Torah says that an Ammonite and a Moabite cannot enter the assembly, the congregation, means they can't marry a Jewish woman. Then says Rabbi Yeshua, "Wait a second. Already 600 years ago, Sanharib, the king of Assyria, conquered all the nations, and he had a policy of exiling people and transferring populations. Therefore, says Rabbi Yeshua, the people who themselves... people who today think they're Ammonites and Moabites, they're really not. All the nations have been mixed up. And the principle is, if we don't know what nation they're from, we say they're from the majority. Let's say, for example, if I have 10 pieces of meat on the table, and one is non-kosher and 9 are kosher, and they get mixed up.
They're all not kosher.
Then they're all kosher. They're all kosher. We follow the majority. So in other words, they get mixed up, and then one piece, you single it out, and you say, is this kosher or not? The halakha is kosher. The same thing with the Ammonites and the Moabites. They got mixed up. They're all mixed up. And now one person comes and says, am I an Ammonite? We look at him, we say, no, you're part of the majority. The majority is not Ammonite, so no one's considered to be Ammonite, the Moabite, and everyone can marry everyone else. Says Rabbi Yeshua, because Sancharib mixed up all the nations, and now we follow the majority, and the Ammonites and the Moabites were a minority, so we don't take any heed to the fact that someone might be an Ammonite or a Moabite. Said Rabban Gamliel to him, "But has it not been said, quote, but afterwards I'll bring back the captivity of the children of Ammon, saith the Lord," a verse from Jeremiah. So you see that God brought all the nations back to their original boundaries. And to today, whoever lives in the land of Ammon, we have to assume he's really, really, really an Ammonite. So that they have already been returned. To which Rabbi Yeshua replied, "Has it not been said, quote, and I will turn the captivity of my people Israel, and Amos will bring the Jews back," says God. And have they not been returned? We know the Jews have not been returned. So if the Jews haven't been returned, how can you think that the Ammonites have been returned? So Rabbi Yeshua sticks to his guns and says that the nations are all mixed up, and therefore we won't relate to this particular person as an Ammonite. Forthwith, they permitted him to enter the congregation. In other words, Rabban Gamliel was defeated. Rabban Gamliel thereupon said, "This being the case, I will go and apologize to Rabbi Yeshua." When he reached his house, Rabban Gamliel reached the house of Rabbi Yeshua, he saw that the walls were black. He said to him, from the walls of your house, it is apparent that you are a charcoal burner. That's what he did for a living. He took wood and made charcoal of it. And his house smelled like a, and looked like a fireplace. He replied, alas for the generation of which you are the leader, seeing that you know nothing of the troubles of the scholars, their struggles to support and sustain themselves. He said to him, I apologize, forgive me. He paid no attention to him. Do what he said out of respect for my father. That is to say, forgive me because of the greatness of my father. He then became reconciled to him. Rabbi Yeshua accepted the apology. They said, who will go and tell the rabbis? Who will go and tell the rabbis we've been reconciled? Which means that Rabbi Yeshua is willing to let Rabban Gamliel continue to be the head, the patriarch. A certain launderer said to them, I will go. Rabbi Yeshua sent a message to the Beit Midrash with the launderer, saying, let him who is accustomed to wear the robe wear it. Shall he who is not accustomed to wear the robe say to him who is accustomed to wear the robe, take off the robe and I'll put it on. In other words, the person who used to wear the robe of the patriarch, let him continue to wear the robe of the patriarch, and let not someone who doesn't wear the robe put on the robe and tell the other one to take it off. So Rabbi Yeshua is giving in, reconciled. Rabban Gamliel should go back to being the patriarch. Said Rabbi Akiva to the rabbis, lock the doors so that the servants of Rabban Gamliel should not come and upset the rabbis. Rabbi Akiva heard this launderer knocking at the door, telling the story of a robe. Rabbi Akiva said, ignore him. It's just Rabban Gamliel trying to cause problems again, trying to get his throne back after we deposed him. Lock the doors. Said Rabbi Yeshua, apparently the launderer came back and said, the rabbis won't listen to me. Said Rabbi Yeshua, I had better go up and go to them. He came and knocked at the door. He said to them, let the sprinkler son of a sprinkler sprinkle. Shall he who is neither a sprinkler nor the son of a sprinkler say to the sprinkler son of a sprinkler, your water is cave water and your ashes are oven ashes. Sprinkler means a priest who sprinkles the blood on the altar. And the idea is that someone who's a Kohen is always a Kohen, and someone who's not a Kohen can't say the Kohen, you're not a Kohen. And in the same sense, Rabban Gamliel has the office. You can't just take it away from him, says Rabbi Yeshua. We have to give back the office to Rabban Gamliel because it's really his. The office of the patriarch. Said Rabbi Akiva to him, Rabbi Yeshua, you have received your apology. Have we done anything except out of regard for your honor? Now, all we did was because of your honor. If you're now reconciled with Rabban Gamliel, we'll accept what you want. You want Rabban Gamliel back on the throne? I'm using throne, it's not a good word. Back in the position, he can have it. Tomorrow morning, you and I will rise early to his door. Now, you and I, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua, the greatest rabbis of the generation, will go back to Rabban Gamliel and offer him his position back. They said, how shall we do? Shall we depose Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? We have a rule that we may raise an object to a higher grade of sanctity, but must not degrade it to a lower. We can't remove Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah for no reason. He's a good guy.
Because he's head of the Sanhedrin?
He's now head of the Sanhedrin. He's now the patriarch. If we let one master preach on one Sabbath and one on the next, this will cause jealousy. Let therefore Rabban Gamliel preach three Sabbaths and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah one Sabbath. They made a rotation. And who was that certain disciple? It was Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. End of the story. You can't believe how much depth is in this story. How much meaning is here and how much relevance.
That's
so much has been written.
How much truth. That's what I say. Are these stories just, I mean, and all these stories, is that actually, I mean, you just, do we think...
Historically?
Yes.
These are most probably stories that are based on a kernel of truth of what happened, but they're literary creations that were written generations later. Mm-hmm. They don't reflect history. Mm-hmm. They reflect ideology. Mm-hmm. They're lessons. And by the way, we don't have time to look at how carefully this is structured and crafted. Every single word has a place and a structure here. But that's really for literary critics. We don't have time for that. We want to look at the ideas. So let's go back to the beginning of the story. Okay, here we go. The story begins in the second paragraph. at the beginning. It is related that a certain disciple came before Rabbi Yeshua and asked him, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? He replied, it's optional. Rabbi Yeshua was asked a halachic question. He gave the answer as he understood it. And that's fine. He's one of the greatest scholars of his generation. He says it's optional. You can pray it if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to. He then presented himself before Rabbi Gamliel, the same student, who it turns out was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, as the last line of the story told us, and asked him, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? He replied, it's compulsory. So the student, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, went to a different rabbi, Rabbi Gamliel, and asked the same question and got the opposite answer. And we don't know why this student went to a second rabbi for a second opinion. Perhaps he just wanted to know. Perhaps he wanted to stir up some controversy. We don't know. After this student got this opposing answer from Rabbi Gamliel, who said it's compulsory, the student went on and said, I'm reading, but he said, did not Rabbi Yeshua tell me that it's optional? So now he's stirring up controversy. Now, Rabbi Gamliel, you tell me compulsory. Rabbi Yeshua just told me a few minutes ago or a few days ago that it's optional. What am I going to do? Asked the student. He said, Rabbi Gamliel said, wait till the shield bearers enter the Beit HaMidrash. It reminds me, like when I was 6 years old, my mother would say, wait till your father comes home. Rabbi Gamliel, when he hears that Rabbi Yeshua said optional, Rabbi Gamliel seems to be upset. He seems to be bothered. Is he bothered because he thinks that the halakha that Rabbi Yeshua stated is wrong? Or is he bothered because of the affront to his authority, that someone taught different than what he teaches? Not clear. It says, wait till the hachamim, the sages, enter the Beit Midrash. Perhaps it's significant that Rabbi Gamliel refers to the sages as shield bearers, as warriors. It could be that Rabbi Gamliel, we hear from here, sees tension in the Beit Midrash, sees war in the Beit Midrash. Okay. When the shield bearers came in, someone rose and inquired, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? Now clearly, it's not a coincidence that someone rose and asked the question, that someone was planted there. Rabbi Gamliel planted him. It might have been that he planted the original student to ask the question, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, it might be someone else. But in any case, Rabbi Gamliel wants to bring this to a confrontation, wants to bring it to a head. So, someone asks, is the evening tefillah compulsory or optional? And Rabbi Gamliel replied. Right? Someone got up and asked the question, and the head of the whole body gets up and says, it is compulsory. Now, that's his opinion. It's compulsory. He knows that Rabbi Yeshua holds that it's optional. If Rabbi Yeshua holds it's optional, then many other sages must hold the same thing. Rabbi Yeshua is just about the greatest sage of the generation. Many of the rabbis are his students. But Rabbi Gamliel doesn't say, we'll take a vote. He doesn't say, we'll have a discussion. He says, it is compulsory. So he's stifling discussion. It's not to be discussed. I'm telling you, on my authority as head of the Sanhedrin, it is compulsory. And Rabbi Gamliel went on. Said Rabban Gamliel to the sages, is there anyone who disputes this? That's a challenge. He knows that many people dispute it. He wants to see if anyone will
stand up
and say, I challenge you. And then Rabbi Yeshua replied. And he said, no. Mm. No one disagrees. What's going on here?
He wimped out.
Exactly. Oh, it's Rabbi Yeshua knows that Rabban Gamliel is a high-handed leader, and he knows that Rabban Gamliel is looking for a fight, and he capitulates. There won't be any fights. Your authority says compulsory, we'll accept it. And you'd think at this point Rabban Gamliel won, but that's not the end.
He's not giving up.
Not giving up. He said to him, did they not report you to me as saying that's optional? Rabbi Yeshua is willing to give in. We don't want any fights. We'll accept your authority. It's just not worth fighting with you because your authority is so high-handed. We'll let it slide. But Rabban Gamliel won't let it slide. He wants to assert his authority, not just that the tefillah will be declared mandatory, but he wants to make sure such a thing will never happen again. He wants to show that no one can speak in his place. He then went on, Yeshua, stand up. Notice he doesn't call him Rabbi Yeshua, he says Yeshua. Yeshua, stand up and let them testify against you. Now, Rabbi Yeshua lied. And he obviously felt that he could lie for the purpose of keeping peace here. But Rabban Gamliel won't accept it. You're lying. You spoke to the student and said it's optional, even you, though you know that I, Rabban Gamliel, hold it's mandatory. Let them testify against you. Rabbi Yeshua stood up and said, were I alive and the witness is dead, the living can contradict the dead. In other words, if the witness wasn't standing here, I would hold my position that I never said anything about this case at all. But the witness is alive. But now that he's alive and I'm alive, how can the living contradict the living? Mm-hmm. So Rabbi Yeshua is admitting that he taught that it's optional and now he lied. And now what happens? Rabban Gamliel remains sitting and expounding. Rabbi Yeshua remains standing. In other words, he's trying to humiliate him. And it's going for 5 minutes and 10 minutes and 15 minutes and a half an hour and 2 hours and 3 hours. And Rabbi Yeshua is like being punished by being standing in the corner for hours on end until all the people, meaning all the members of the academy, began to shout and say to Chutzpit, the announcer, stop. Right, turn off the microphone. And he stopped. So this is about a grassroots rebellion against authority. That's what it's about.
But you know, there's something that bothers me about it. Rabbi Gamliel is the top, and Rabbi Yeshua is under him. But Rabbi Yeshua was asked first. So he wasn't really trying to cross his superior. He was asked first.
Yeah.
And then he yielded to his superior when it came up. So it seems like a very understandable situation to me. You know, I said that, but you know what? You went higher than me, so now you have to accept the higher authority.
You're right. That's exactly why all the students are revolting against Rabban Gamliel, because he just doesn't seem to be fair.
Well, but I thought Rabbi Yeshua is saying, you know, maybe I said that, but I yield to the higher authority because... If the student would have gone to the higher authority first, there wouldn't be an issue.
Yes.
Well, you won't last speak.
You think I'm not getting what you're saying?
You know, you are. You're just saying yes.
Remember,
there's no discussion here.
Remember last week's story,
right,
in which Rabban Gamliel also exhibited high-handed authority, but there we could have forgiven him because he was really doing it to save the Jewish people from schism. But here, he's gone too far. He seems to believe that only his opinion carries any weight. He's not willing to have any discussion, not willing for any pluralism, not willing for any democracy. It's just his way, the highway. And the rabbis say, it's not that he's doing it simply to save the Jewish people from schism. He's just overexerting himself, and we have to stand up to this.
So he's like a theocrat, or like creating a theocracy?
He's an autocrat, let's say.
Okay.
Not a theocracy. He's an autocrat. He says, it's my way. Now, obviously, he's doing it because he believes that his way is the right way. You need authority, you need a central authority. He doesn't believe in democracy. He doesn't believe in other opinions. There should be one halachic way, and he's in charge.
Okay.
But the rabbis say he's gone too far. He's gone too far. Having that position doesn't mean that all debate should be shut off and all other opinions should be silenced.
And he just carries on and on and on like beating a dead horse. I mean, it just keeps on.
Because he really wants to make the point that I am in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And anyone who crosses me, even unintentionally, he will be humiliated.
Mm-hmm. So you think he's trying to avoid what happened with the Rosh Chodesh issue?
He's certainly trying to avoid that. It should never happen again. Oh, my authority should be accepted. Yeah. But again, the rabbis say he is going too far. He's crossed a line.
Okay.
Then they say, how long is Rabban Gamliel to go on insulting Rabbi Yeshua? Concerning the new year, last year insulted him. insulted him, no matter the first one in the affair of Rosh Tzedek, which I mentioned 20 minutes ago, now he insults him again. Come, let us depose him. This is really a revolt. This is a, how do you say, a coup?
Yeah.
Reminds me of Egypt and so many other places in the world in the paper these days. So this is about a grassroots effort to reconstitute authority in a more democratic fashion. Whom shall we appoint instead? We can hardly appoint Rabbi Yeshua because he is one of the parties involved. Okay. We can hardly appoint Rabbi Akiva because perhaps Rabbi Gamliel will bring a curse on him because he has no ancestral merit. So the rabbis are quite suspicious of Rabbi Gamliel. If we depose him, he's going to try in every means to get back at us. We have to be careful here. So they really have a lot of suspicion and a lot of mistrust of Rabbi Gamliel. Let us then appoint Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. Again, he's a student of Rabbi Yeshua, who is wise and rich and the tenth in descent from Ezra. He is wise, so that if anyone puts a question to him, he will be able to answer it. He is rich, so that if occasion arises for paying court to Caesar, he will be able to do so. He is tenth in descent from Ezra, so that he has ancestral merit, and Rabbi Gamliel cannot bring a curse on him. They're thinking of essential matters, knowledge, and they're thinking of politics. They're looking at the broad picture. It's a balance. They went and said to him, will your honor consent to become head of the academy? He replied, I'll go and consult the members of my family. So his first answer is a democratic answer, right? He believes in consultation. Even in this matter, he won't decide on his own, as opposed to Rabbi Gamliel, who decided everything on his own. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, I'll ask my wife. He went and consulted his wife. She said to him, perhaps they will depose you later on. In other words, she's afraid of getting involved in politics. There's always going to be things behind the back. It's always going to be yes, no. You'll be in favor one day, you won't be in favor another day. She seems to be, perhaps you could say in general, wary of politics. Perhaps actually, she's an aristocrat who's not so happy with the fact that Rabban Gamla was deposed. He replied to her, there's a proverb, let a man use a cup of honor for one day, even if it be broken the next day. In other words, we'll take things as they come. He's willing to be involved in politics. And he's not afraid of the idea that there's going to be controversy and there's going to be perhaps good days and bad days. Perhaps they will depose me, but he's willing to be involved in the game of politics again, for the good and for the bad. She said to him, you have no white hair. Because externally, you don't fit the bill. You look too young. They won't accept your authority. Because externals matter, she says. Externals matter. He was 18 years old that day. A miracle was wrought for him, and 18 rows of hair on his beard turned white. So that's interesting. It's a miracle that says that externals do matter, but they don't. In other words, what people see does matter. But not because it really matters.
It's because what people see.
It's what people, that's what they see. So they have to see some, we'll give them something good to see. We'll give them white hair to see. And then, of course, quotes what he says, behold, I'm like 70 years. He was like, but he wasn't really. Now comes the good part. Atana taught, on that day the doorkeeper was removed and permission was given for the disciples to enter. For Rabbi Gamliel had issued a proclamation saying, no disciple whose character does not correspond to his exterior may enter the Beit Midrash. On that day, many stools were added, etc. In other words, until this day, when Rabbi Gamliel was in charge, he prevented people who wanted to come and study from studying. He gave them a test. And the test was, I see externally you look very good and proper and religious and upright. I want to see if inside you're really as good as you claim to be. And apparently most of those who came to study, he turned away. And now, so in other words, he was an elitist. He was an aristocrat. Not everyone can study Torah. And his foundation for his aristocracy was he only wanted the best. When he was deposed, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah is now ahead, and Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah is a student of Rabbi Yeshua, they changed the system. Democracy. Anyone can learn Torah. Doesn't matter. And the idea is that everyone deserves to learn, and the Torah will affect them. The Torah will change them. The Torah will make them better. You don't have to be better before you come in. You have to be better when you walk out. It's a completely different way of looking at it. As opposed to an elitist system, it is a pluralistic system or democratic system, and they added 400 stools or 700 stools, that's a lot of people who came to the Beit Midrash. And of course, these were simpler people. These were more common people. They weren't scholars. But everyone should have a chance of learning Torah. Interesting, it says, three lines from the bottom of this paragraph, Rabban Gamliel became alarmed when he saw all the people coming to study. And he said, perhaps, God forbid, I withheld Torah from Israel. In other words, he's involved in a process of introspection. Perhaps Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah are right, and I was wrong. He was shown in his dream white casks full of ashes. In other words, white symbolizes purity. The outside of these jars is white, but inside is mere ashes. So his dream shows him that all these people are coming in. Externally, they say they want to learn Torah, but inside they're just ashes. The dream confirms to him that it was right all along. We shouldn't let these people in, they're just ashes. So he has a self-confirming dream, confirming his a particularistic and elitist approach. But then the editor says, this fellow really means nothing. He was shown this only to appease him. We don't accept his dream. Because we, the editors of the story, we believe in pluralism. We believe in democracy. We believe everyone should learn. The dream was just to make him feel better, the poor guy. But we know he's wrong. Atana taught Eduyot was formulated on that day. And wherever the expression on the day is used refers to that day, there was no halakha about which any doubt exists in the Beit Midrash, which was not fully elucidated. Eduyot is a tractate in the Mishnah. Now, all the tractates of the Mishnah are on a particular topic, whether it's blessings, whether it's Shabbat, whether it's Yom Kippur, whether it's Rosh Hashanah, except for the tractate of Eduyot. Eduyot means testimony. Tractate of Eduyot has no one subject. What it is testimony of old people and of people who are the children of old people who said, I remember that in the time of the temple, before it was destroyed, things were done in X fashion, all different subjects. It's just testimony. And the idea is that on this day, when they let all of the common people into the Beit Midrash, the common people had a great fund of wisdom to offer of what the traditions used to be before the temple was destroyed and everything was wiped out. In other words, Torah was gained, was multiplied by the fact that we allowed even the non-scholars into the Beit Midrash. Torah was multiplied, Torah was preserved, and Torah was developed. Rabban Gamliel also did not absent himself from the Beit Midrash a single hour. In other words, even though he's brooding and he's upset and he lost his authority, he still comes to the Beit Midrash every day to participate in the discussions the rabbis are having. In his day, there were no discussions. It was just, I say. But now there's discussions and he's willing to participate. And then the whole story of the proselyte, which we... The story of the proselyte. So just think of the story of the proselyte. What happens in the story? Rabban Gamliel wants to keep the proselyte out. Rabbi Yeshua wants to let him in. Just like the beginning of the story, the previous paragraph, Rabban Gamliel prevented the common people from coming in. Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah let them in. So Rabbi Yeshua gets his way. And he defeats Rabban Gamliel in debate, proving that the proselyte should be allowed to enter into the Jewish people. It's all about inclusion. It's all about bringing the outside in. It's all about more opinions, more people, more approaches. And then we have the case of the apology. Rabbi Gamliel thereupon said, this being the case, I'll apologize. So what happens with the apology? He comes to Rabbi Yeshua's house and he sees Rabbi Yeshua's, the walls are black. Black and white play a role in the story if you've seen. He sees that the walls are black, meaning he's not fitting to be a scholar. Externally, he's not fitting to be a scholar, but internally, he is. Rabban Gamliel didn't know anything about the people, didn't know who his students were. So let me ask you, if it's going to take 5 minutes, should I stop here and do it next time, or should I go on? Not clear. Okay, so let me just go on. If someone has to leave, then please leave. So... Rabbi Yeshua says, you didn't talk to people, you didn't understand them, you didn't know you. I was your student for so many years, you didn't know that I'm a charcoal burner, you didn't know how hard my life is. You're an aristocrat, you're rich, you live in this big house. You didn't understand the people, you were insular. Whereas Rabbi Yeshua now is, of course, in favor of a Beit Midrash in which people know each other, they respect each other, they listen to each other's opinion. And they reconcile. They reconcile. And they send someone to the Beit Midrash to say that we're going to accept Rabban Gamliel to come back. And he comes back, and
he's... Why did they decide he could come back? Because he all of a sudden had this revelation that he really didn't know people?
Apparently, he had a certain degree of repentance. He understood that there is another way here. Okay. And I'll just emphasize, at the very end of the story, is that Rabban Gamliel was reinstated, and a rotation is developed. Rabban Gamliel is three Shabbatot, Elazar ben Azariah is one Shabbat.
That's where we got rabbis and assistant rabbis.
Perhaps. But it's not just that.
Associate rabbi.
But the associate rabbi, one Shabbat a month, is head of the Beit Midrash. So in the end, what do we have?
More democratic.
We have situation. The leadership is democratic. There's two leaders and not one. There are more people in the Beit Midrash. The proselytes are let in, even though the Torah seems to say not, but times have changed. Situation has changed. The halach has to be reapplied in a creative fashion. And Rabban Gamliel has learned to participate in discussion. So the values of discussion, of inclusion, of pluralism have won the day. And really a new approach to Torah is developing, as opposed to the early approach was autocratic and elitist and exclusive, was for the limited number of people. Now everyone gets to participate, and Torah in the end grows and expands.
That may be one of the secrets.
Other religions really don't. I mean, we are really quite open-minded even that long ago.
Comes back to here.
That might be one of the reasons we survived.
Perhaps.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think so.
So in future discussions, did Rabbi Gamliel be more open? Were there more, or did this end?
Well, that's hard to say, because, again, this didn't happen historically. Okay. This is a creation of 100 years later. But it expresses to us the values that the authors of the Talmud want to pass on to us. And there's so much more here. Time is short. I'm sorry.
Maybe how more democratic rule came to be.